The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Stirring the Cauldron on the Para-X Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Merry meet everybody and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. We're going back to Roswell tonight with author Thomas Carey. Now, he's a U.S. Air Force veteran who held a top secret security clearance, and he spent the last 23 years, give or take, investigating the Roswell incident and has published more than 35 articles about it. And together with best-selling author Donald Schmidt, they authored several other books, including Witness to Roswell, Children of Roswell, and UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson. And tonight he's with us to talk about the new book, Roswell, The Ultimate Cold Case. Now, I'm going to sound like a broken record once again and mention that if anybody has any questions in the chat room for our guest, just send me a message, private message in the chat room, and sorry, cat was scaring me to death. So send me a private message in chat, and if anybody is listening outside the chat room, you can easily join in by going to paraxradionetwork.com. So Tom, hi, it's nice having you back. It's been way, way too long.
Yes, hello Marla, great to be with you. I'd just like to correct you a little bit on your intro there.
Please do. I need correction sometimes.
This year marks 30 years for me on the Roswell case. 30
wow.
years this year. Wow. Started in 1991. And since I was last on your show, we have come out with three more books since then. The Roswell, The Ultimate Cold Case, the Roswell, The Chronological Pictorial, and a book that just came out this month called Touched by Roswell. Touched by Roswell. So we have three new books since I was last on your show.
You guys are busy. Really, really busy.
So, all right. I'm also consulting with the Travel Channel. We're putting together, as they tell me, a 6-part documentary on the Roswell incident, a 6-parter. And I've been working with them for a couple months now. And also next year, I may as well point this out as well, since I'm talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Next year, 2022, is that right? 2022.
Uh-huh.
I get my ears mixed up, but will be the 75th anniversary of the Roswell crash, 1947. And we will be reissuing an updated version of our best-selling Witness to Roswell book.
Mm.
So it'll be a 75th anniversary edition of our bestseller Witness to Roswell, which is actually Don Schmidt's and my first Roswell book back in 2007 with a second edition 2009. So, as we speak, Marla, Don Schmidt and I have co-authored 10 books on the Roswell case.
Wow. Well, you know, there might be some people that are young and may not have heard, if much of anything, about the Roswell incident. So can you kind of give a brief overview for those who might not know what we're talking about?
Oh, my goodness.
I know. Brief overview is an oxymoron. Yeah. Just the facts, ma'am.
You know, because we have over 600 first and secondhand witnesses, and that was our mandate. But I'll try to recapitulate the case. In 1947, the month of July, there was a crash of something, an object of some sort that had five occupants from somewhere else, not of this earth. And it was reported as the crash or the capture or crash of a flying saucer. Those were the terms that the military used. They also used flying disc. That was the other one. It was reported as such in the first report and then the first press release. Well, before the press release gets out and before the day's over, they change the story to from a flying saucer from another world to a weather balloon. Now, how does it go from a flying saucer that traveled the universe to get here and crash to a weather balloon that even a six-year-old would recognize, you know? Rubber, balsa wood, baling twine, and tin foil. Anybody would recognize that. Well, that's been the... and so they covered it up. That's where the cover-up started. It's still with us today. So the cover-up involved threatening civilians, having people from the base in Roswell. The reason it's called the Roswell incident was because the 509th Bomb Group from the Roswell Army Airfield just south of the town of Roswell in New Mexico was the one that made the recovery. Now, this was the outfit that ended World War II by dropping two atomic bombs on Japan. So this was the highest military unit that we had in our inventory back then. The only nuclear-tipped strike force in the world somehow confused a weather balloon with a spaceship, if you want to believe that. So that cover-up has been with us ever since. But in the early 1990s, this is like 1993-94, there was a reinvestigation of the case administered. It was started by a U.S. representative from New Mexico wanting to know whether there was any paperwork stored anywhere associated with whatever happened there. And they couldn't find any. All the paperwork had been destroyed. And the Air Force came out again, not only with a weather balloon, but with this thing called Project Mogul. We're talking now 1994-95. Project Mogul was a high-altitude balloon array designed to go way up in the stratosphere and stay up there and listen in for a potential atomic bomb test by the Soviet Union. And that's what the Air Force finally said it was. That's their position today. As far as the little bodies are concerned that people reported seeing, they said, well, no, they weren't. They were not little bodies. They were dime store mannequins that the Air Force was using in high altitude parachute tests. And now, you know, the bodies that were reported were like 3.5 to 4 feet tall, Marla, with large heads. That was the big overriding description, was they were 3.5 to 4 feet tall, very frail, but had these large heads. And what else did they have? They said that the dime store mannequins were like over 6 feet, you know, and they had human features. So how could you mix up the two? But if you call up the Air Force today, and we haven't had their latest report, which is due out this month, they will tell you it was Project Mogul and these dime store mannequins. That's where their position is today. Mm-hmm. But as you know, this month we are eagerly expecting a report from the Department of Defense about what they know about UFOs.
That'll be interesting.
Also have to tell you,
yeah,
that I've heard through the grapevine that in this report, Roswell is off the shell. It's not going to be mentioned at all. The word Roswell will not be mentioned in this report, because that would indicate that the Air Force has been lying to us and the government has been lying to us for 75 years. Wow. So that's off the table.
Damn. I want to backtrack a minute. When did you and how did you become interested in Roswell to put, you know, so much in for 30 years?
I became interested when I read the first Roswell book in 1980 called The Roswell Incident by William Moore and Charles Berlitz. William Moore and Stanton Friedman did the actual research, but Charles Berlitz had just had a book about a popular book about the Bermuda Triangle, so they figured people knew him, but they didn't know Stan Friedman, so they put William Moore and Charles Berlitz. But that book blew me away. It was talking about not lights in the sky, and I know you're aware of, you know, people, oh, I saw this light in the sky. It went this way and that way. Oh, wow, tell me more, you know.
Right.
This was about a real nuts and bolts crash with little bodies. There was a cover-up. There were death threats. And it caught my fancy, Marla. And all the other UFO cases, I was a big fan of Donald Kehoe at the time. I guess, was the Stan Friedman of the 1940s and 1950s, trying to gain credibility for the UFO phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
But this book blew me away, and it washed all other UFO cases away. It was the only one I was interested in. And I guess about 10 years, also in 1980 was a big year, was the first TV exposure for the Roswell case on the show called In Search Of. I don't know if you remember that show or not.
Oh, yeah.
It was hosted by Leonard Nimoy, Dr. Spock, and he interviewed Jesse Marcel, the base intelligence officer from Roswell in 1947. He interviewed Jesse out at the site, out at the crash site. That was the first TV exposure for the Roswell incident. It was in 1980. Also in 1980, there was a motion picture came out starring Robert Vaughn called Hangar 18.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everybody know, most people have heard of Hangar 18. It's where extraterrestrial hardware and software and beings and documents and all sorts of artifacts are kept at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. And that became a motion picture in 1980. So you have, it's a trifecta.
And
so it was 10 years before the next Roswell book, 1991, when a fellow named Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, my now current investigative partner for the last, since 1998. So I don't know how many, that's 23 years.
My math is worse than yours, so we'll go for it.
I think it's like 20. Since 1998.
That'll work.
My investigative partner and co-author of 10 books. They were reopening the Roswell case. They were members of QFOS, the Center for UFO Studies, founded by J. Allen Hynek, the astronomer that was the Air Force scientific consultant for Project Blue Book. And they were, I read in their magazine that the QFOS put out every other month, that they were reopening the case. So I wanted to find out what they had accomplished about locating the archaeologists who allegedly had discovered the downed craft. And so I called up Kevin, and they said, well, he said, well, we interviewed one or two, but they didn't know anything, blah, 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 blah. So I said, look, I said, these archaeologists were allegedly from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. I live just outside of Philadelphia in a little township called Huntington Valley. And I said, look, Kevin, my background is in archaeology and anthropology. Let me go down to the university and see what I can find out. And that's how I became involved, not only in the interest in the case, but how I became involved in the actual investigation of the case.
Wow. Got a chat room question that came in. We'll get to that before it goes away and I forget. It's from Henry, and he says, I think there was two different crash sites also, and wants to know your opinion about that.
Yes, that's a good question. After reading the Roswell incident book, I was confused as to the crash sites. I said, were there two sites, one site? I never could figure it out from the Roswell incident book. But in our investigation involving Randall, Schmidt, and myself, we were able to eliminate, when the 1980 book by Berlitz and Moore came out, they didn't have a crash site with bodies close to the Roswell crash site. So they incorporated a site about 150 miles to the west where there was only one witness, a guy named Barney Barnett, a soil conservation engineer in New Mexico. He claimed to have seen a down saucer with the bodies outside on his way home from the desert out there in the plains of San Augustine in western New Mexico. The problem with that case is that Barney never gave a year. He never gave a year for when he had that experience. But William Moore and Friedman and Berlitz, they incorporated that into their Roswell story. We were able to eliminate that from the Roswell story. I won't go into how we did that, but the Plains of San Augustine crash is not part of the Roswell story. Now, to get to the Roswell case, there are three known sites associated with the Roswell crash. The first one is when the ship, we believe it blew up from a lightning strike or some sort of inner explosion, 33 and a half miles southeast of the town of Corona, New Mexico. It's actually closer to Corona than Roswell. But it blew up, and the outer shell came down in small pieces. And that was the first site. We call that the debris field site. Mm-hmm. It was run by a rancher by the name of Mac Brazel. And it was the one, the J.B. Foster Ranch. And Mac Brazel, a sheep rancher, was the foreman on the ranch, and he actually was the first one to the crash site and found all this debris. That's the first site. The second site, and this we're talking now about the Roswell crash site, not the Plains of San Augustine. That's out. Mm-hmm. The second site is when the ship exploded. Two of the occupants of the spaceship were blown out. And they came to rest on a low bluff about 2.5 miles east of the debris field site, the Brazel debris field site. And that's where Mac found, as the witness said, something else. And it turned out to be two of the occupants of the spaceship met their fate on a low bluff. We call it the D. Proctor site, who is the son of Loretta Proctor, another rancher there, and he was the one who actually revealed that, because he was with Mac at the time, Mac Brazel. He was mm-hmm. with him at the time they discovered that. He told his mother, Loretta Proctor, and she told us, and I have a picture of me standing on top of that bluff somewhere in the book. So that's the second site. Now, the third and last site of the Roswell crash is, we call it the impact site, because that's where the inner cabin of the ship that withstood the explosion, whether it was a lightning strike or something else, we don't know, most likely a lightning strike. That's where the inner cabin came to rest about 35 miles east-southeast of the debris field site, much closer to the town of Roswell. Now, at that site, there were no bodies at the debris field site. There were two bodies on the Deep Proctor site, the low bluff. Now at this impact site is where the inner cabin, two dead occupants, and one live, still alive, walking around, were found. Mm. So we call that the impact site. And so there are your three sites associated with the Roswell crash. It is confusing. I mean, it took me a couple of years to figure it out, but it is confusing. But those are the three sites associated with the Roswell crash. The Plains of San Augustine, as I said, was a construct that the Friedman and Moore and Berlitz incorporated into their 1980 book, but it had nothing to do with the Roswell crash.
Okay. Well, you know, it's funny because when you asked me the other day when you were last on the show, you know, I really thought it was like a couple of years at the most and was kind of flipped out when I realized it was 2016 since you've been here.
Yes.
And so, you know, in the book, you bring all new exclusive eyewitness testimonies to light. And I know the last time you were here, we spoke about deathbed confessions, because if those people had been threatened into silence for years, they had nothing to lose by finally opening up on their deathbeds. But now time is gone. Now it's 75 years since the crash. Are there very many people who have been silent for years and years?
Yes, they are very silent now. They're all
well,
dead.
Yeah, but I mean, are they all dead?
Marla, as we know, what I can address is of all of the witnesses, the firsthand witnesses that we are aware of, they're all dead.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that there might be somebody out there that we never did locate or that we never did speak to and are unaware of who might still be alive. But all of the firsthand witnesses and many of the secondhand witnesses now, of which we interviewed, were aware of, et cetera, they're all gone. They're mm-hmm. all gone.
So maybe third generations are still, you know, familiar with the story.
Yes.
And
even some grandchildren are going now.
And it might be that some of them will come up with stories you'd never heard. You know, I mean,
yes.
The more you put it out there, people will come. Yeah.
Yes, we believe that we've actually captured the framework of the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the witnesses that we were getting later on were all fit into the framework nicely. So we believe we got the framework, but we're, you know, still open to anybody that has any information about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we always plug it in somewhere, or perhaps it's something new. So we never really close the issue if there is information out there. But as far mm-hmm. as our proactive investigation, Marla, that's pretty much has come to an end, because everybody, we've spoken to everybody that we know of, and everybody mm-hmm. that we know of a first and second hand variety, they're all gone now.
Yeah. Well, you know, many people do believe that we're visited by extraterrestrials and that they live among us, and we all take it kind of as a grain of salt, not really a big deal anymore. But I've had several guests in recent years. They were saying that there would be just a full disclosure in 2020. Well, that never happened.
I predicted that one right.
See, and you weren't the only one. But it's curious that since it's believed that a great deal of evidence was found at the crash site, and if I'm not mistaken, you know, they're still under lock and key, wouldn't you think that they would at some point open up and start talking about it? I mean, it's been so long.
Here's the thing, Marla, is that threats of your life now are not something that is doable. Back in 1947, they could, you know, probably get away with stuff like that. But now, there's no more, the threats of life are gone. But what it is, people are, if they're still employed somewhere, they're afraid of losing their job. Take this Luis Elizondo fellow who broke the, remember, he's the one that revealed that video of the Navy pilot, following that disc. He's the one that broke that story 3 years ago. But recently he was interviewed, and they asked him, will Roswell, he says, they asked him if the government had physical evidence, and he said, yes. And so they said, well, what about Roswell? And he said, Roswell's off the table. Don't want to talk about Roswell. And he said, I'm still under contract to somebody, you know. So he was thinking about his employment. So that's the bottom line for everybody is, you can be a whistleblower if you got another job in that you're working on. But to be a whistleblower is to perhaps lose your job.
Right. So,
and it's the same with reporting UFOs. A lot of people see things they don't report because they don't want to either lose their job or they don't want to be ridiculed. I know myself, when I worked in Philadelphia for a large insurance company, I had a fellow in my department. He says, oh, tell me about Roswell. I'm really interested in this stuff. So I told him about Roswell. And every time he saw me after that, do you remember the theme music for The Outer Limits? It went doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo.
Yes.
Every time he saw me at work, he did that. And I said, oh, it was a big mistake I made. It was a big mistake.
Nice to be recognized, so, but...
So yeah, I think people think of ridicule, and they think of perhaps losing their job. Yeah. So we haven't had there's still some people coming forward with information, but a lot of it cannot be checked out. I mean, it's impossible to check it out now.
Yeah.
And we are open to, you know, if somebody has something they want to say, we're all ears. We're all ears, but we're not out there doing the gumshoe work like we used to, because everybody's more or less gone now.
So. Yeah. We've got a couple minutes to break, but, you know, when I was thinking about disclosure and cover-up, wherever those crash victims came from, you would think that someone from their home planet would have known about the crash, or, you know, figured that they were missing or something, and come looking for the victims, and we'd have contact with them. And if that was the case, in your opinion, do you think that our government and perhaps many others around the world are in touch with extraterrestrials on a regular basis? And if so, could it be possible that it's the aliens who aren't allowing disclosure yet?
Wow, that's... you know, from my perspective, that's pretty far out. Our mandate, Marla, was to track down every lead, every witness that we could find before they died. That was our mandate. And we never got around to stories, like you just said, never really got into our minds to, you know, like, where did they come? But I do have a answer for you as to where they came from before the show ends.
Okay.
But stories like you said about walking amongst us and being in control of, I just haven't explored those. Roswell was labor intensive. It was labor intensive interviewing people. And I will say, my own gut feeling is I don't see things like that happening. People from the planet Zeta Reticuli walking around and controlling our government and all that sort of stuff. I just don't see that.
Okay.
But,
No, that's fair. I just thought, well, maybe they came down.
And quite frankly, I never thought much about it. And I thought such stories like that they're too far out for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I think I want to talk a little bit more about the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and Hangar 18 and a whole bunch of other things. So everybody sit tight and we'll be back really soon.
Stirring the Cauldron will be right back. So don't go away.
If you end up with webbed feet,
remember, you've been warned. Missed an episode of Stirring the Cauldron? Then be sure to check out MarlaBrooks.com and check out the archive. And while you're there, check out Marla's weekly Witch's Oracle card reading. Explore the site to find many great resources, such as information on tarot, oracle readings, metaphysical consultations, and links to all of Marla's books. That's MarlaBrooks.com.
Rhett, where are you going?
I'm going back to the Paranormal View, back where I belong.
Please, take me with you.
No, I'm through with everything here. I want to see if there's something left in life I haven't explored. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Rhett, don't run to them. They talk about ghosts and hauntings, UFOs and all kinds of supernatural scary stuff.
You'll never understand, will you, Scarlet?
No!
Well, that's your misfortune.
Rhett, if you go, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear. Line!
Oh, you gotta be kidding.
That's the Paranormal View with your host, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, and Barbara Duncan. Every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on the Para-X Radio Network.
Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
And my guest tonight is Tom Carey, and we're talking about his book, Roswell, The Ultimate Cold Case. And before we get back into Hangar 18, I've got a question from the chat room. And Patsy wants to know, do you think that people who had some of the crash debris were threatened into giving it up, maybe had drugs used on them to see if they hit anything, or that someone out there still has a piece of the crash?
Absolutely, positively. The Air Force spent years trying to get every last piece from civilians. Of course, the parts that were already in their possession were all shipped to Wright-Patterson, but they were looking for pieces that civilians who had gotten to the site first. We have to remember now that civilians had gotten to the site first before the military, and they were used to having airplane crashes out there, off and on, and they would always take souvenirs. And no doubt in this case, we do know that they took souvenirs, pieces of the crash material. And the people that they knew were out there, especially if they had seen the bodies as well, but they suspected of having material, they threatened those people with their lives. Not only the possessor of the material or the person that saw the bodies, but also their entire families. We've got witness statements to that effect, that they threatened the entire families with their lives if they spoke, if they didn't give up. We know that Mac Brazel's son, Bill, 2 years after the incident, this would be 1949, he had, over the past 2 years, in riding the ranch, he would see little pieces of the wreckage that would say, come to the surface of the earth after a rainstorm or something like that. He would pick it up, and he had a little cigar box at home. He put it all in the cigar box. Well, in 1949, these two guys, security guys, they show up at his house. And he says, I knew they were going to not leave until they had that cigar box. So he gave up. how they found out about it, he doesn't know. But they knocked on his door. They wanted that cigar box full of little, he called them, I forget what he called them, little slices, little pieces, little shards of material. Weren't hurting anybody, but they wanted that box. So, yes, they would occasionally go out to the crash sites again and just do ride around to see if anything was out there. And this, we're talking about years later. They brought in a fellow from Wright-Patterson who basically was, the kind of, only in case of fire, only break the glass in case of emergency. He was that kind of a guy. And they sent him out there to threaten all the ranchers because they felt that the surrounding ranchers still had, I still think they have pieces myself, but they have not come forward with them. And why, I don't know. I'm guessing it's maybe they're still fearful. I don't know, because the fear of God was put into them back in 47. And we're hoping, my own belief is that a peace will turn up two ways. One, somebody walking out in the desert, lost or something, stumbling upon a piece. Because we had two archaeological digs out there where on the debris field site and didn't find any pieces. But somebody's going to stumble upon a piece, or one of the ranchers up near Corona or outside of Roswell will somehow decide, okay, I'm going to give this up to the public. And so that's what I believe. But you're right, they did threaten. They did threaten people with knowledge of the crash, knowledge of the bodies, and potential possessors of artifacts. Yes.
Mm-hmm. They may show up from very strange sources, but if they're meant to be, they certainly will. Now, I was talking about Wright-Patterson, and it's connected to Roswell again. We'll just brief thing, because it's the home to Project Blue Book, ground zero for government investigations of UFOs from, 1951 to 69. And it ranks, it ranks up there alongside Area 51 as a subject of enduring speculation. And it's believed that Hangar 18 contains crashed UFOs, bodies. It's a facility for performing alien autopsies and government cover-ups and all that. But there are people that don't believe there is really a Hangar 18. What do you say to that?
that is a good question. There isn't a Hangar 18. It's Hangar 23. But here's why they call it Hangar 18. It didn't all come to me until I actually saw a schematic 3D drawing of Wright-Patterson. And I said, oh, my goodness, that's why they call it Hangar 18. Well, there's this complex at Wright-Patterson called the Building 18 Complex. It's like 8 or 9 buildings. Within that complex, there's one hangar. There's only one hangar plus 8 or 9 buildings around it. And out of convenience, and that's Hangar 23. Now, out of convenience, when somebody wants to know, okay, where's so-and-so, where's Hangar, rather than say, okay, it's look for Hangar 20, they just say it's Hangar 18 because it's within the Building 18 complex. Mm-hmm. Now, what was Hangar 18? Well, during World War II, it was the place where all of the captured Axis aircraft, like Messerschmitts and Japanese Zeros, things like that, that's where they were brought to back engineer them, to take them apart nut by bolt, to see what made them fly, what were their strengths, what were their weaknesses, so that we could design aircraft to defeat them in battle. That's where all of the foreign, they call it the foreign technology, went, Hangar 23. Now, during the Cold War, that's where all the MiGs and the Sukhois and the Russian aircraft went, was to Hangar 23/Hangar 18, because they were already in the back engineering business. So In 1947, the World War II is just over. They'd just been looking at Messerschmitts and Japanese aircraft. Here comes this thing from Roswell that's really foreign technology, you know, really foreign. There was no doubt that that's where it was going to go, and that's why it went to Hangar 23. Now, how did it become 18, besides how I told you, was in 1974, there was this fellow in Florida named Robert Spencer Carr. He was talking, he was like a UFO quote-unquote expert down there. He gave talks on UFOs, but he kept talking about this Hangar 18 at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where all the foreign technology, all the UFO stuff and bodies were stored. And where did he get that information? A lot of military people, they retired to Florida. That and a lot of them worked at Wright-Patterson. So that's where he got the the Hangar 18 story was from retirees from Wright-Patterson that retired to Florida. He got them, and he had his 15 minutes of fame in 1974. And I remember it well. It was on radio and television. And at the time, I was off to the University of Toronto, and that's when the story broke. I don't know how long it lasted, but when I got to Toronto, it was over. So that's how Hangar 18 came about.
Okay. I'm going to talk in a few minutes about the new book, Touched by Roswell, but before we jump into that, we're going to kind of tiptoe into it, because there are a lot of credible witnesses, or, you know, those who have come in connection or had some connection to Roswell. So I want to talk about Neil Armstrong and Edgar Mitchell and their connection, because they're, you know, astronauts are pretty well respected and believed, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Edgar Mitchell was born and grew up in Artesia, which is just a stone's throw from Roswell. And at the time of the incident, he was actually in college in Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's got a doctorate in, astrophysicist or something like that, very well-educated, MIT. Mm-hmm. And but he was out of town when this happened. But up until that point, when he went to the moon on Apollo 14, he came back to New Mexico, and he said what happened was the people felt that they could talk to him because he had been to the moon and he was well respected. So he started getting all of these anecdotal stories from people in New Mexico, in and around Roswell, about the crash in 47. And he says he also had seen documents. He had also seen documents and talked to people, high-ranking officers in the Air Force. And he came to believe that Roswell really, really happened. The UFO crash really happened, based on anecdotal testimony from ranchers plus high-level Air Force officers. He came to that conclusion. So, and Neil Armstrong, he was certainly the first fellow to work on walk on the moon.
Maybe that was work, you know.
Maybe he worked too, but. I forget, you know, quite frankly, Marla, I forget what his testimony. If he's in our book, that means he believed Roswell really happened.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, so let's talk a little bit about the book, because did the chapter in the Roswell Ultimate Cold Case book about Touched by Roswell, was that the catalyst to write the book to follow?
Absolutely. We actually, I wrote that chapter. So you're getting it from the horse's mouth here.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a lot of positive feedback around that chapter. So we thought, let's do a whole book on that. So this year, actually, it just came out as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
We wrote a book called Touched by Roswell,
I have it right here. I forget what the subtitle is. Crash. Wait a minute. I want to get this title right.
I've got it on my Kindle, but it takes too long to look up.
I have it right here. Touched by Roswell, Crash Encounters of the Rich and Famous. Now, what it is, it's not your typical Roswell book where you start listing the witnesses one after the other. We've done enough of those. Mm-hmm. And because we believe we've nailed the case. We don't need any more than 600. We have 600 odd witnesses. What's 601 going to do? But so we put this book together, and we have 127 of the rich and famous. Now, rich and famous, we're talking about actors and actresses and other famous people. And the book starts out, the very first one is a fellow by the name of, let me go through some of the names here.
Yes, because people will be amazed at this. Yeah.
Yes, there's both David and Dan Aykroyd, Adrian Barbeau, of course, Dr. Werner Von Braun, of course. We have a local NFL football player here in Philadelphia named Tom Brookshire. Chris Carter, the producer of The X-Files, President Jimmy Carter, Ozzy Osbourne,
Bill Clinton, you said.
President Bill and Hillary Clinton, Denise Crosby, who was in Star Trek, Ted Danson, remember the Cheers? He's in there.
You go from actors to singers to politicians to news anchors. I mean, many people.
Yeah. Jackie Gleason.
Yes, that was the one that made me laugh out loud. The
country and western singer. Mm-hmm. Barry Goldwater, of course, a senator. Even Bob Guccione. Don Schmidt wrote that chapter, but Bob Guccione, Brent Gumbel, the fellow from Real Sports.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, Webb Hubble. Do you remember Webb Hubble? He was in Bill Clinton's administration. He was a lawyer who was an assistant attorney general. Larry King, of course.
Yes.
But we have 127. Of these people, Dwight Yoakam, the country and western singer,
mm-hmm.
Robert Wise, the director of West Side Story, and a number of Sound of Music,
mm-hmm.
Run Silent, Run Deep, that sort of thing. Mickey Rooney.
Of all people, right? and that's why I'm going to invite you back to talk about this in the near future, because those stories are way different from the other books. But all these people...
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's absolutely amazing. I mean, when I'm looking at things, and some of the people, I figured, okay, but then I see Ozzy Osbourne and Jackie Gleason. Well, Jackie Gleason jumped out at me first. I'm, what the heck?
Yep.
So, yeah, it'll be really interesting to talk about. So we'll do that in the near future. So
yes.
I've got a couple more questions before we run out of things and run out of time.
I want to, before the show's over, I want to tell you where they came from.
Okay. You can tell me that now.
Well, it's at some point recently, I did start thinking of how did they get here from there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the... distances between the stars is so great that it's just unfeasible that you got to have some mechanism to shrink space or shrink time. And one of our associates, the first one I interviewed, there was this fellow, one of the paperclip Germans who came over from World War II. With the Werner von Braun team, his name was Ernst Steinhoff. rocket scientist. He became involved in the Roswell investigation and the Air Force's UFO projects and what have you. He died in 1987, I think. Well, I interviewed his two sons. Mm-hmm. And the one son said, "Oh, I don't know anything. I don't know anything." Oh, great! Yeah, your father's like, yeah, you know, you never asked about it. Well, mm-hmm. That was Hans. That was Hans Steinhoff. I interviewed the other son, Ralph. He says, "I don't know anything either." Blah 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 blah. But he did tell me that those who talk don't know, and those who know don't talk. He said, that's what my father told me. And he said, oh, by the way, it wasn't extraterrestrial. The Roswell crash was not extraterrestrial. I said, what do you mean? He said, it was extra-dimensional. Mm. Extra-dimensional, meaning time travelers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he had to get that from his father. And So it's not Uncle Harry at the bar. It's a rocket scientist who was heavily involved. Well, there was one other fellow that was interviewed by Bill Burns, another UFO investigator, and his name was George Hoover. He was a Navy commander, of all things, in part of the Roswell team of investigators. Werner von Braun was the father of our space program. George Hoover was the grandfather of our space satellite technology. He was a genius. They had him on von Braun's team, the UFO investigations, and he was interviewed by William Burns, and he said Roswell was a crash of was a crash event from somewhere else, somewhere mm-hmm. else. So mm-hmm. what does that mean? He says it was not so much extraterrestrial as extratemporal. Time mm-hmm. travelers.
Yeah.
And he went a step further. He said he believed that they possibly were us from the future. They were us from the future. And mm-hmm. so I'm thinking, well, these fellas are in the know. You know, these mm-hmm. fellas were there. They had investigated all this stuff, and they came to the conclusion that, speaking of Roswell, that it was a case of time travelers. But mm-hmm. they wound up in what they call the corporeal state, the physical state. And mm-hmm. So they remained after they crashed.
Yeah.
So that's where I've come to that conclusion myself, or that's what I'm leaning towards.
It's very likely. Definitely. One more quick question before you tell everybody where to find you and all that good stuff. What's the red closed stamp underneath the book's title up there? Is that a cold case that has been closed? I mean, it sounds like...
Yes, that we had an argument with our publisher about that. It was supposed to be called Roswell, the Ultimate Cold Case. Well, at the time, we figured there's no more to do, you know, from our perspective. Everybody was dead. So we insisted that we put the red... My daughter actually did the graphics for it. Mm-hmm. We inserted the word closed, the ultimate cold case closed, because our feeling was that our proactive investigation was closed, that this would be our final book. And lo and behold, we've done two more books after that. We've got another one coming out next year. But the theme we wanted to transmit was that our proactive shaking the tree, calling every day, looking for new witnesses. That phase is done because they're all dead as far as we know. Mm-hmm. There may be some out there that we don't know about, but they're all gone. And we feel that we've nailed the case. Anything further short of a piece of physical wreckage, anything in a witness variety would be just, as they say, gilding the lily. We would be mm-hmm. gilding the lily. It's already it's already there, and you're just adding sparkle to it. So, mm-hmm. but the only thing we're missing, Marla, is a piece of physical evidence.
Right. And it may be hiding in Hangar 18. Or someplace else, I don't know. But anyway, like I said, we got to get out of here in a minute or two. So tell everybody about your website, where they can find out about you and your books and all kinds of good stuff.
Yes, our website is all one word, www.roswellinvestigator.com. That's www.roswellinvestigator.com. You can go to there, go to our website. We have all of our books shown there. Just click on the one you want to buy, and it will take you to Amazon. So you can buy all of our books there. We have stories about ourselves, our history, lots of photos. So that's our site.
It's a good place to get lost in for, you know, an hour or so, because there's just a lot of things to look into and look after, and there is contact information where you can be contacted.
Yes.
On there, right?
Yes, our contact information is there. Everything that you would be looking for is there. We try to update it as we can. Don is busy. I'm busy. So, if we're behind the times, we're trying real hard to catch up.
So, it takes a while sometimes. I have trouble keeping mine every week to put up new shows on my website. It's like,
yeah.
I call it editing jail, but
yes.
That's okay. It's worth it.
Our vendor of physical books, if they still have bookstores, is Barnes & Noble. I think they're the last one left as far as bookstores. Barnes & Noble or Amazon, or you can go to our website and just click on the book that you want. Mm-hmm. And it'll take you to Amazon. Oh, also Barnes & Noble has a website as well.
They do. So, and also on Amazon, I hate getting things on Kindle, and that's not bad about Kindle. I just want to hold a book in my hand. But I did get this book on Kindle because I thought it might take them too long to get it to me in time for the show.
I like paper. I like paper myself. I don't like electronic stuff.
It's a necessary evil, and we'll get over it.
Yes,
all right.
I don't have a what do they call them? Smartphones. I refuse to have one.
I worried about getting one. I thought it would be smarter than me, but fortunately I aced it. All right, so we will see you shortly to talk about Touched by Roswell. So I want to thank you, though, for being here tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure, Mara.
We'll do it again, and let's thank everybody for listening in as well. And until next time, everybody, blessed be, and merry meet again. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Please join us again next week at the same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited.